Back in 1945, the private sector won World War II. Made a ship and landed guys on the freaking moon. The vaccine for polio, yeah, we built that too. That's not what you can do for your country, but what you can do for you. No, we can't, no, we can't. It's out of our hands. And if you've got a problem, you can blame supply-demand. No, we can't, no, we can't. So you may as well not vote. And let me turn your hope into just nope. We can't let you women make choices on your own. And we don't trust your doctor. She should be a mom at home. We can't change global warming because it's just a fraud. If it weren't for Exxon, there'd be no Santa Claus. No, we can't, no, we can't save the auto industry. But it worked, goddammit, now we can't accept history.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Forte. Today I have another guest, and actually it's another person who's listened to the show. You know what? This is now the second person in this many weeks that I interview that's told me, hey, I listened to the show, and all of a sudden I'm just like, oh, sweet. We're starting to get famous. This is going to make things so much easier now, because at least everyone who walks into this knows what to expect. So today, my guest is actually a friend of the show. We've been talking for a little while, and I even tried to get this guy to write a new theme song, but I'm a difficult motherfucker, and I always want to make sure that it's the right tone, and you guys are just so difficult. But with that in mind, he's a very talented musician. His band Plush Gun seems to be getting more and more popular all the time, and your video plays are just you just keep climbing. Dan and Gala, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. You know what? I meant to do it way, way, way before, but I was not very well disciplined. That was the honest truth, and it just kind of fell through the cracks.
I was also I'm still very ill-disciplined. Your cat capped me on a week where I think I can make it work.
Here's the thing though, it's always up to the host because you can pester someone until they give you an interview. No, there's no guarantee it's going to be a good one. Like, right. You should wake them up at 2 o'clock in the morning and say like, "Come on, buddy, wake the fuck up. We're going to be talking now." But that was my fault. But with me having done the whole book thing and just doubled down on Get Atheist, my whole thing now is to actually be organized and get people on the show that I've wanted to get on the show for a little while. And you're one of those, so happy time. Awesome. I got to fucking wrangle you and capture you and be like, "You're on the show now, bitch."
Wrangled me through Facebook. It was a very complicated process.
You know what, though? That is my number one tool for getting people on the show. I mean, it's amazing. Before Facebook, you were fucked. Like, sending someone an email that would just get lost in the fray? Nah, dude.
Well, it's also my number one source of getting laid, so I feel like it's a very useful apparatus.
Yeah, see, I got into that whole online, meeting people online, before Facebook actually started getting really big. So I never really got to take full advantage of that. But I'm like, who needs a dating site now? You got Facebook.
Right. See, I was failed at the approach, getting someone's number at a bar. That was not my style, because it implies like an objective like reality. You're either going to get rejected or not. But if you just get their Facebook information, you can have a little bit more time to like sort of.
Well, you could be rejected over a longer period of time.
Right, exactly.
You're just dragging it out. It's nicer.
You can navigate the subtext, I think, over a longer period of time when you're sober.
No, truthfully, though, the best thing about it is not actually getting a person's contact information. It's their friends, because, right. Like, just with anybody, the first time, if you go on a date with someone, I'm telling you, like, I know what the rate of success is on most dates. It's about 10%. That's not really good,
Right.
But they've got friends that and a lot of times I always find like when someone you go out with someone you thought you had a few things in common, turns out you're not compatible, but her friends are probably similar but more to your liking, so it's perfect that way. That's what Facebook really helps. It helps date the other person's friend.
Right.
Hopefully that doesn't cause
and their ex-friends.
Yeah, well, this is where I think the problem lies and why I'm glad that I never got all part of that Facebook thing, because the problem is that your relationships, in a sense, become very open to the whole world, and I never liked that.
Right. It's very hard to keep something undefined.
Yeah, and even the whole it's complicated thing. I mean, does anyone buy that?
No.
Nah.
No, I don't know anybody who uses that. And why would you even like expressly put that out to the world?
you're inviting conflict, as far as I'm concerned.
Right, exactly.
The only people I've ever seen it's complicated, like has a relationship status of it's complicated, were people looking for threesomes, and probably just about to break up too, right after.
Right. They were looking for the terminal threesome.
Yeah, the one that ends it all.
Yeah.
So give me a little bit of an impression about, like, because we're going to have a song that's going to be playing right before the show, the little sample. And this sample is of a song you wrote for Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
Tell us about the song.
Okay, well, I kind of felt bad for Mitt Romney because, you know, Obama had that whole "Yes, we can" thing 4 years ago. And just nobody seems to be picking up on anything about Mitt Romney. So I decided to basically do the same thing for him, but just changing it to "No, we can't." and basically implying that the government can't do anything. And so why even try? Why even vote? Obviously, it's a parody, but it's just one of those things. I was like at the gym and I'm like, oh, we can actually turn his incredibly terrible policies into a really funny song.
I don't see. Here's the thing about Romney is, what are his policies exactly?
His policies are just not Obama's. It's like whatever, because he kind of put himself in this hole where he has to make the Tea Party happy, and the Tea Party has no plans. All they want is just not Obama. So his policies as strictly not Obama as possible.
I think that should be his slogan: not Obama.
Right.
I think it would definitely serve us some better. I don't know if you watched the Republican National Convention.
Yeah.
But I felt you know, the whole time it just felt like they were trying to create an illusion of a party that really doesn't exist. Like the entire time they're just like, "Well, number one, we won't invite anyone that actually led this country." That's the first thing. And all of a sudden you're just like, "Who was that speaker?" That weird dude, what's his name again? He's got that odd sounding name.
Reince Priebus?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who the fuck is that little worm? Doesn't he look like the fucking, like an annoying little rat?
Yeah, he has Michael Steele's job. So Michael Steele was head of the RNC. So now Reince Priebus is the head of the RNC. It's a very strange guy.
Do you mean the figurehead, right? Because that's what's stupid about that whole title. It's not like Michael Steele dictated anything. He was just he was just there to try to amass money, and he seemed to actually have done a pretty fucking good job by the time they fired him.
He did. The problem was that like there's a certain dogma now, I think, within the Republican Party that is basically there. It just doesn't have to be a party anymore because the party itself is just a combination of like a coalition of special interests. So all they want the guy that's running the show to be is like some kind of pushover. I feel the more pushover they are, the less idealistic they would be of anything actually practically useful happening.
This is the weird thing that I find about the evolution in American politics, because I think a lot of people, probably still individuals that we would qualify as rhinos, individuals that are just like, I'm a Republican. And I'm like, I don't think that your Republicanism has anything to do with the platforms and beliefs of the Republican Party. And as a perfect example, it's let me say Clint Eastwood. Is there anyone whose values so obviously contradict the Republican parties, and yet he's at the convention?
Right.
What the fuck is he doing there? Does he think it's the 1960s Republicans or something?
That's the thing that's so confusing here. I mean, Clint Eastwood is he's aware of climate change being a real thing. He supports gay marriage. I feel like at a certain point, it's almost just we're part of this party, and it's too late to turn back now kind of mentality.
But don't you think that there's a bit of that on the Democrat side? Like, let me play devil's advocate here, because I'm sure you watched the DNC a little while ago when they decided last minute to include God and Israel in their platform, despite the fact that it was quite obvious that, A, they didn't have the two-thirds majority that was needed, and B, they had made the decisions beforehand, and C, it was a decision that was actually dictated by the fucking Republican Party. So if a person is thinking to themselves, well, there's a solution to all this madness, isn't just, I mean, not that I'm saying this is the equivalent madness, but isn't the insanity of one party actually dictating the insanity of the other?
I think to a certain degree, where the Democrats stand now is that they have the space to be a centrist party that really has a lot more followers. So, I think the activists that are progressive want to move away from this God talk, want to move away from the jingoist mentality, want to move away from even like just totally laying, like being hands off from Israel. But to an extent, from a Democratic Party perspective, that growth it will imply that they can win multiple elections in a row. Like they can kind of dominate the next generation if that's the case. But I do understand what you're saying. I feel like a lot of American liberals kind of just really vividly still remember the Bush administration. And like we kind of are still reacting against that administration pretty like viscerally still. So I feel like in a weird way, yeah, that makes sense. Like the representation of the Democratic Party is not representing necessarily its most active activists, but they're kind of doing it in a sort of a way to just get to.
It's a catch-all, right? They released a wide net, and you know, I think there's a reason why most, say, leftist movements tend to fail. Is that it tends to eat each other up. I think the one thing that you can kind of admire about the right is they always double down on shit. They're like,
oh yeah, totally.
And meanwhile, on our side, we would rather bite each other's heads off over minutiae than actually say, well, we need to have a bit of a bigger picture here, and maybe we don't get everything we want, but that's okay. I mean, it seems to me as though we're just like, is there a part of us that just seems to, I don't want to say being dogmatic, but uncompromising about even our progressiveness.
Well, I think it's part of the idea of progressivism is that you have critical thinking and you take that seriously. So I think part of us rejects a platform that doesn't fit what we consider a universal morality. Whereas I think the right is part of their identity to sort of take orders. And I think that might be mean to say, but I feel like they've done all these sort of studies on like why people choose to be conservative, and a lot of it is just kind of a fear of change. And like, so where we're coming from is like, where change is good, and then the next conversation after that is, well, what is the next change? And that's when we start eating each other up. That's when, you know, you get the anarchists fighting with the socialists, or fighting with the Democratic socialists. I mean, it's just like you. It's kind of like academia. You can come up with a new term for anything.
Well, that's true. And plus, I suppose in a way, it still feels to me as though we are looking for a better solution. I mean, I think I mentioned this in a few shows that one of the issues that I have currently, and I suppose every once in a while somebody will accuse me of being an ageist, which I may not necessarily deny, but because of the population bubble that exists right now, in terms of the baby boomers, mm-hmm. I feel as though this is an example of this is a failure of democracy on the part of young people to be able to express their desire for change. Like, I don't know if you agree with me here, but I feel as though our generation is going to be the most impotent generation ever. Like, where our dads won't die because they take great medicine now, and besides, the age of retirement just keeps being pushed up. So by the time that they're dead, we already have to pass the fucking baton over and be like, well, here you go. We weren't able to do anything, and we couldn't stand up to our dad.
Yeah. I actually completely agree with you. Though I don't think that's necessarily ageism. I think that's sort of generationism. And I think that's totally fair. I think you can totally blame the baby boomers for, at least in the United States, supporting the war in Iraq when they so fervently fought against the Vietnam War. And also, I kind of look at the upcoming generation, and I'm also freaked out by them, too. So, I mean, I feel like I'm not...
stuck in a rock and a hard place. I don't know what to do.
Yeah,
I just want to jump off a bridge.
Yeah, that's probably the best choice for progressives.
I did get an email from a fan who actually was like... He was an older gentleman, and he's like, well, I feel like you're being unfair and putting the blame. And you know what? One of my other shows, I'm actually going to deal with this letter in general. But the one thing I did want to say, and this is kind of important, is the fact that people don't realize that the hippies from the 60s, for instance, the anti-war protesters, they really didn't do that much. I know that it seems as though they did because we always see those images. But you have to remember that they were still a very small minority. And for the most part, people were just still kind of like today where they're like, no, I'm more worried about commies and what's going to happen and fucking kill them all. It's not my problem. And a bunch of soft-hearted people, generally speaking, they make a person feel ashamed of what they're doing, but so rarely stop them from doing it.
Right.
Like, how long do you have to shame someone before they finally are like, oh, well, all right, I'll stop. And I think that's one of the things that I think people should realize. Yes, what I think that generation did was definitely soften society. I see them as soft hearts that sort of taught us some important lessons, but they didn't win at the time. They just got shot a bunch of times, beaten up, and still sent to war. You know?
Right.
What did they win at the end of the day?
I was reading an interesting article. I forget who wrote it, but how basically the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, was making a lot of huge change and was very aggressive and like being active in civil rights and even bringing up corporatism in the mid 60s. But that was definitely co-opted by this kind of fashion movement, which was just the hippie movement, just totally co-opted the left and turned it into basically a fashion industry.
Well, that's not just that, but also, I mean, the biggest problem with the hippies, and I think this is what hurt the Occupy movement, is A, lack of focus, mm-hmm. and B, a bunch of people that give you the impression that they're just freeloaders. Like, how many hippies were stealing, freeloading, and mooching? Yeah,
right.
A lot. And it doesn't really help your fucking movement when you're like, well, you should all be like us. Really? Well, who's going to build the fucking future? You guys? You're not builders.
The Occupy movement definitely suffered from, I think, their 100% inclusion policy. And I feel like, especially with Occupy, one of the problems was that you have Fox News and all these conservative media outlets basically choosing the worst situations, the most rotten apples, and then presenting that as if that is the movement. Having this dogma against having a priority was also, I think, a big problem with the Occupy movement.
Yeah, I think it was just one thing that people don't realize, and I think that this is a mistake that we progressives make, is we just assume, I'm going to talk to a person for half an hour, and then I'm going to convince them of all the things that I want to convince them of. Not realizing, you know what? A, no one's going to listen to you for half an hour. B, you're not going to be able to convince them of everything that you say. And C, if you try to do that, everything that you said that was actually really important gets muddied. And I remember that even on the side of people that were actually pro-Occupy, there seemed to still, like, the message was not coming out very clear. I think they should have had just one message. One very fucking simple message is that you must separate investment banks from, you know, banks that people keep their money in. That's it.
Right.
That is it.
Yeah.
Like,
Glass-Steagall. That was like, I mean, that could have been it. And or similarly, like, how much, like, campaign finance reform. I feel like that would have summed it up.
Sure. The corporations are not people. That's an easy fight.
Right.
But they didn't choose that one fight. They chose, let's take on 1,000 takers because we're morally right, and that's just going to win the fucking day.
It's the here, read this pamphlet mentality. It's like, yeah, you're going to affect change with a fucking pamphlet.
Right, and I feel like to some degree we forget, or maybe we assume too much about people. And I don't want to say that people are just basically sheep, but people are basically sheep. We're sheepish in a lot of different ways, okay? I'm sheepish about plenty of things. I don't consider every aspect of my fucking life. It's impossible. There's just some things that you're on autopilot. Now, what you and I are on autopilot might be different from somebody else's, but we still have to recognize that if someone wanted me to watch different movies or different shows, they would have to send me a pretty clear and simple message about where I should switch my focus to. And as weird as that sounds to compare the two, I'm like, they're not that different. Attention is limited, and it's being filled by all kinds of things. In fact, you and I are filling people's attention and diverting them. You with music, me with just the sound of my voice.
Right.
So are we not distracting people? Are we not taking them away from something important? We might. We might. But at least if you had something that was kind of important that you wanted to say to those individuals, my one suggestion would be like, please, keep it fucking simple. You're not talking to geniuses here. A person
right.
is smart, but people are stupid. You're talking to the masses. And you're just...
It's not like you're basically... I mean, it's not like you're going on Reddit and everyone's going to read what you write and everyone's going to agree with you already. And, like, you know, it's not like you can write these things and everyone be like, oh, that's an amazing sentence and paragraph. Let me upvote that. Like, we're talking about people who still believe that animals and humans lived on the same planet at the same time. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance going on there.
Hard to reconcile all that cognitive dissonance at once. Yeah.
Right.
It's a long road ahead, let me tell you something. And there's plenty of people, you're just not going to change their minds. It doesn't even matter how much evidence you have. Some people, there's just too much invested. Like, I don't know if you listened to the last interview I gave just on Monday with Jerry DeWitt. He's the next preacher who works for the clergy, Recovering from Religion and the Clergy Project.
Uh-huh.
And he was just talking about like this idea that of identity suicide, right? Of just say there's something that you believe or don't believe in anymore and it's driving you crazy and you think everybody else should know. Well, a lot of people are not talking about that because they know that if they do, the people around them will reject them.
Mm-hmm.
And this leads me, I don't know if you've noticed this, to a different point, is that recently I've seen a lot of people arguing online or on Facebook or something like that and unfriending people who disagree with them. I don't know if you... This seems to be a growing trend now. People just defriending individuals, being like, I think that what you're saying is horrible, I don't want you in my circle anymore, blah, blah. And because we're living more online now, we can start doing that. We can start triaging people. And this... I don't know if you feel this the same way, but I feel this is a worrisome development in the way that we choose to interact with other people. Because one of the things I think the big shame is that let's say you and I have very different opinions about, I don't know, let's say racism, just as a classic example. I feel like if you were saying something racist, then I decided, you know what, I don't want to interact with you anymore. You're hopeless. I'm going to go away. I'm like, I actually think that we're doing that person a gigantic disservice. I think we're doing all of us a huge disservice by deciding I'm not going to engage with a person who disagrees with me, even if they're wrong.
I absolutely agree. I think that there's something that is almost it's mirrored by exactly what's happening in American politics right now. I feel like it started when urban lifestyle and suburban lifestyle, people that chose to live there, started to develop like similar political views. And since then, it's almost like people now move to places that share their political values. When you were just back in the day, you know, back in that sort of great times, in quotes, people would be forced to essentially cooperate. People would be forced to listen to each other. And I feel like that's happening online now because of that sort of, because we can choose our own communities, we can choose our own information sources, we can choose which news, which blogs reinforce our values. It's almost like that person that disagrees with you becomes this object of all of the things that are wrong with humanity. And like, yeah, you're not going to make any progress there. You're not going to build any coalitions. You might actually be able to talk to them and convince them that global warming is actually happening just by a simple way of interacting with them and asking how they feel the weather is and like in Oklahoma right now. Like there's no way of going forward if there's no coalition, if there's no compromise and no discussion.
Yeah, and in a sense too, I mean, like, think back in the old days where maintaining friendships was just a matter of geography, right? And mm-hmm. you had to be fucking careful. And say a friend came over and he said something that really pissed you off. Like, holy shit, how could he have said that? And it's just like it's a terrible time. And you go back home and you're just like, I don't want to ever speak to this motherfucker again. But because you live in the same place, you probably have to. And then, you know, odds are if you talked, you realize, well, that guy didn't really mean what he was saying. And neither did you. But you were pushed to these opposite positions because you disagreed. And now you had to agree with a portion of things that maybe you didn't, you know, like because the people who agreed with you were just trying to push you towards one extreme and you were forced the other way too. I feel like, I mean, the danger facing the future is that we interact with only people that agree with us. We only read what we agree with. I make it a point every fucking day to read opinions that I don't agree with. It's hard. I don't know if you do this. It's really fucking, like, it hurts your brain.
Yeah. I know, I do it. I do it because I'm kind of, just because I'm such a politics geek, I'm kind of curious of how the right is trying to frame things and how and what kind of implications that might have as far as whether the left is winning the message. But I think a good example of what you were just talking about, did you hear about this Jonathan Crohn kid? He was like this 13-year-old GOP wunderkind that was like spoke to CPAC and he like gave this speech. He sold books. Have you ever heard of that guy?
He didn't have a little radio show where he said like terribly.
No.
That's a different kid.
That's a different kid. This is more like he just sold books to the inner circle of the people that buy Republican books. So apparently the big deal with this kid is that he. He was interviewed by Politico about a couple months ago, and he was just like, yeah, I kind of grew up, and he was like, I was 13 years old. I grew up in North Carolina. I think that's where he was. All he listened to was talk radio. Like he didn't think about these things, and then he did, and now he's like going to NYU. I actually had a pretty fun like Twitter interaction with him because I went to NYU, so I was like, oh, you know, giving him some
you
advice.
You liberal elite East Coaster.
Yeah. And this kid was destroyed. After that political article, his parents, friends of his parents, like disowned them as friends. Like people started to like attack him saying he was doing this because he was on drugs or because he wanted to get laid. Like not because he actually just thought about it for a second. And I feel like that's just like that's sad. The idea that his parents' friends are disowning them because their son, like, grew a brain and actually started critically thinking. And it was clear he was a smart kid. Like, when I was watching this kid when he was giving these speeches, I was like, yeah, it's not going to last long.
You're smart, you're just really immature, and you don't know how to look at information online.
Right. And, like, you know, once the beard starts growing, you might have a desire to move to Brooklyn someday. And that's exactly what
Brooklyn
happened.
Brooklyn or Portland, right? The liberal East Coast, or, well, Portland's more, you know. Portland's the center, or, and I guess it's West, I guess.
Portland, yeah.
Yeah, it's West Coast. But yeah, same elitist environments.
I mean, I was a Republican when I was 13. Like, I feel like kids just don't like change.
Or, well, what were your parents? Were they, like, super liberal?
No, my parents are actually kind of traditional Reagan Democrats.
I thought maybe it was one of those things where, what was that show with Michael J. Fox where it's not All in the Family?
Okay,
it
was Family Ties. Trying to remember. Family Ties.
Ties, right. Okay, but the thing about Family Ties, the I guess the comedy was that here were two very hippie-ish parents that have conservative kids, because I guess the whole twist is your kids are going to be exactly the opposite of you, which I thought was always kind of, you know, funny. Like it's their own style of rebellion, I suppose.
Right.
And I mean, in a way we all rebel in some form or another, we all rebel, whether or not we take a political or religious opinion that seems to rebel against the beliefs of our parents, but we will all do this.
Right.
It's predictable and almost kind of sad, but I think it's just a normal human thing. I know what I rebelled towards. You know what my rebellion was? I was anti-drug.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't drink. Wow. I didn't smoke weed. And then I woke up.
Yeah, I was actually straight edge in high school until college. I basically was like, once I get to college, then those rules go out the window.
No, they stayed for me in college, eh?
Did they?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, yeah. Like, my college was, I think David Letterman ranked it number two or three party school. This is Bishop's University in Lenoxville, where there was a bar like every block. And, you know, part of my rebellion is like, I don't want to be like these lamos. But that, like I said before, I mean, that's a predictable thing. I'm sure that if you would have looked at my personality known that I very against authority and have I had myself hippie-ish parents themselves. I was the Family Ties kid.
When it came to drugs.
When it came to drugs, yeah. Because my you know, you got to understand, though, I am a Quebecer. I don't know if you know anything about French Canadians, but other than the fact that we're huge separatists, we're also really, really progressive about environmental issues and stuff like that. It's just that they hate the English. That's all. Right. They hate English people. They're very progressive and about rights, but they don't like English people. And they force you to write everything in French, which is not form of fascism at all.
Yeah, no, that's not nationalism either.
No, of course not, no. And it's not like Quebec was ever sort of said any nice things about Hitler and his fascist party. Oh, wait, they did.
No, the funny thing is, like, I actually, when I was a kid, I was very politically active at a young age. Like, when I was 8 years old, I was personally responsible for Ross Perot winning our elementary school mock election, which
Ross
I'm still very proud
Perot.
Of. Yeah.
That's
apparently,
a...
what do they call it? Ballot intimidation bus before it got popular.
But you were defending for Ross Perot?
Oh yeah, I was 9 years old and I was all on the Perot train.
A 9 year old on the Perot train. Wow. No.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting.
Did you get laid in high school and college? Like what?
It took till college. Yeah. I'm not going to deny that. But I mean, I was very Catholic. I was very Republican when I was 13. My parents were Catholic, but they weren't that Catholic. I think I kind of like took that and ran away with it.
They were American Catholic. It's a form of Catholicism.
It is, and it's actually I kind of have a soft spot for American Catholicism because it's just about like oh our neighbors and our family.
Yeah, but you know what though, that might be the image. The same way that they always do that, you know, like the Church of Latter-day Saints always do that. It's about family and hating black people.
Right, of course. Well, how I got on my path to like atheism actually is that I wound up dating like a very actual Catholic girl, and in high school, like she was wearing a Beatles shirt, and I happened to really love the Beatles, so I immediately had that sort of like 14-year-old, oh, we have everything in common. Assumption. It turns out I go to her house and her family has all these like Beatles books, but they're all taped over certain parts and like censored.
Do they have the whole Beatles as Communism book? Do you ever see that?
No.
I should send you. I'll send you an image to this. It's fucking fantastic. It's like an old book from like I don't know what year. It must be the 1960s. But anyways, it had pictures of all of the Beatles with their long hair. And it was like the book was really red, and it's like how the Beatles are basically communism.
That's hilarious. No, actually, what's so weird? Like this family like loved the Beatles, but they didn't like certain parts, so they'd black it out.
So weird.
And like, and they were also they were very anti-gay, very anti-choice, and those are two things that I was kind of pro. And so our relationship was basically we'd hang out and make out, and then we'd go home and get on like Instant Messenger and argue.
It must have made the making out so much hotter though.
It did actually. I mean, for the 3 weeks that this relationship lasted, I made out more than I ever in my life. But I think that like if you were to take the hours making out versus hours talking ratio, that's probably still the highest ratio that I've had in a relationship since.
I do like how her Catholicism, her intense Catholicism, forced you to look at your own weak sauce kind.
It really did. Like I started to argue, and like she was being literally correct about what the Bible was saying to a certain degree. Like when it came to like the passages she was throwing out, and I was like, "Well, if that's wrong. Then what else is wrong?" and like you know, when she actually what caused us to break up is that her family had a prayer meeting to expel the demon inside of me.
Oh,
and
that's brutal.
That's when I was like, okay, this is really a fucked up situation.
Did they show up with like oils and stuff? Like what, did they have props?
No, they were kind enough to do this behind my back.
An exorcism behind your back. It's like the baptism
exactly,
of the
yeah.
dead. It's like, oh yeah, yeah that's a real thing.
They had these, like family prayer circles every night. And like, I feel like every time she'd tell me about them, my heart sank a little bit because it just made me want to make out with her that much less. And then, like,
oh, boner suppressant.
Like, I tried, and then she tells me about this exorcism from afar thing, and I'm just like, I can't do this anymore. I'm an atheist. I'm a socialist, I think, too. It's really just everything went
along
with
it. I got to get out of here.
next year, literally, I started showing up to class wearing, like, old, like, SDS gear. Just, like, going just straight to 1960s syndicated, anarcho-syndicalism.
Yeah, no, I used to be a huge anarcho-syndicalistic, too. You know who corrupted me? Naomi Klein. That's who corrupted me.
Really?
Yeah. Did you ever watch her documentary, The Take?
No.
Yeah, see, if you watch that, you would want to be an anarcho-syndicalist. Because it's very compelling. You know, especially when they talk about the situation in Argentina, where essentially all of these, a bunch of businesses in Argentina did a run for the bank at one point where their economy started to tank. They took $50 million out of the economy and left everyone who had a bank account, like, fucked. And then they went away. And then all of a sudden what happened is that a number of workers took over these factories. And the one factory they keep tabs on is this tile factory. And it's run entirely by the workers. The boss has been kicked out. And in order to gain support from the locals, they donate tiles to hospitals and all of this other kind of stuff. So they still have to force the police to get out of there. But they're like, the other guy had shut it down. We got it working. We're making money. It's our fucking factory. He owed us the money. Case closed. And you watch that, and you're like, it's so much what I want to see happen everywhere else.
Yeah.
But you know, you get caught up in it, right? You're just like, this is the solution. You realize that in life, there is no single solution. There is no one ideology that will work 100% fucking of the time. And I think that that's where we find ourselves, you know, where we're still looking. We're still vulnerable to someone who tells us that they have the perfect ideology. Well, we find ourselves in a situation where we're able to accept that there is no perfect one, but we take the best of everything. You think that's possible?
Right. I mean, like, I feel like that's the ultimate problem with academic politics and philosophy is that the perfect solution is so easy to isolate within, like, certain situations, but once other factors are introduced, that whole, like, ecosystem just implodes. And that's why, I mean, I just really go back to the basics. Like, I mean, I'm kind of a Rousseauvian when it comes to just, like, if people were aware, it doesn't matter what conclusion they come to, but if information is equally, like, spread, I think we would come to a better conclusion.
Well, yes and no. I mean, we have to admit that there's a certain degree, A, of information saturation, where I think plenty of people are getting information. It's just bad information.
Right.
And the other problem is, how are you supposed to analyze the information that you're getting and ensure that it's the correct one and ensure that you... Like, I was watching this one video. I don't know if you saw this. It was the Young Turks. They put up a video and they were just talking about this... Camp Quest, or I think it's called, the atheist camp, and they were just saying a bunch of things that are, say, not factually true at all. They had done no research about it. They have a very popular online show, but who's sort of like keeping tabs? Who's fact-checking these guys, right?
Right.
I mean, I don't want to idealize this imaginary world that never existed where, let's say, a person who's trying to tell the news can be held accountable for it. Because obviously that reality doesn't exist. And maybe it never existed. But maybe that's the reality we fucking need. Right? Where a person does that and they pretend that there's some kind of information outlet is just like, fail, you failed. And you should be fucking punished. But, you know, it's just like the Republican speech where how many lies were in Paul Ryan's speech?
Right.
Even Fox News couldn't stop itself. They were like, yeah, that's not true.
Right.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, they got those lies went so far and were so ridiculous that I feel like Fox News had to at least to say that they were a news organization, mention it in one blog that was very hidden, by the way.
It got found out.
Well, it got posted. Like, I'm kind of a Redditor. I'm kind of obsessed with Reddit. I know that you can make fun of it, and it should be made fun of for how, like, you know, masturbatory it is, but it does bring these out. Like, that is a very useful tool for, like, bringing out those articles and making them very popular. I feel like also, like, the more that information is shared by a trusted community of information, that would kind of create that might possibly be the reaction, like the appropriate reaction against something that is not truthful. It's, you don't really win by writing a blog post saying, oh, they were wrong here, because that just enters the static. But if you have an actual community that prides itself on taking in information, then that can actually, I think, can be used as a weapon against it.
I think we're just going to find ourselves in a situation, though, where the information saturation reaches a fucking critical point, right? A critical mass. I try to think about myself and the show that I produce. There is a side of me, I will not lie, that takes... I don't want to say that I'm a journalist. Not at all. But there every once in a while, people who listen to the show know that there's a couple of issues that I take to heart that I'll always have a very strong, let's say, journalistic inclination towards. And when I say journalistic, inclination, what I mean by that specifically is that here's one avenue where I'm not willing to just speak out of my ass. Where every word that I say, I'm like, put it up to scrutiny. I want other people to be aware of this. But you know what's tough? I'm a comedy show. Like, who the fuck am I to be talking about these types of issues? But my worry, and this is my fear, and I guess my frustration, is that sometimes I feel like I am the lone voice, where everybody else is just talking about issues that... I don't know if they're unimportant, but they just don't really... They're not interested necessarily in being objectively true. They're just... it's just people interested in putting through their own specific ideology, and the rest of the information can go fuck itself. And anybody who disagrees can go fuck themselves. So what do we... And we already talked about this in the first part. More people are starting to move away from individuals that they disagree with. Mm-hmm. And I mean, not that I want to sound alarmist, but I'm like, they did that before, and it led to a civil war, right? That was a geographic... separation, but now that's not even necessary to be separated. I can just talk to people that I agree with all day, and I could be a conservative living in the most liberal fucking town, and I could still never even interact or have a conversation, deep conversation, with anyone who disagreed with me.
Right.
And for me, like, the loss of the importance of information, of its reliability in a sense, because anyone can publish information, including you and I, so that it, you know. And who's really who's analyzing the information to ensure it's correct?
Well, this, I feel like this is sort of like the relativity of truth is what's so scary, because I think that's what creates so many false equivalencies. I mean, you have like basically CNN, for example, will basically say like would basically put climate change, which is happening is real. It actually is, you know, it's a real thing that's proven by scientists after scientists after scientists, and it's only more and more true. Still says one side says this, one other side says that. And it's just kind of like the loudest voice pushes the conversation in that environment.
True, but I think actually in that sense, this is where the failure of journalists these days, like, in order to understand how do you represent objective truth, knowing that A, say, witness accounts are always wrong, B, the information that you have is unreliable, and sometimes even completely false. With these two factors, it would be bad enough. But now compound this with the fact that you can create your own narrative, and people will believe it. All you need to do is just create a convincing narrative. That's it. The truth, objective reality, is not important. So when a person says, like, when journalists are trying to figure out, well, how do I capture the truth of the story? The default that they go to is like, well, why don't I present both sides and let people determine for themselves? This is still, I think, the way that a lot of journalists function. This is why Fox News pretends they're journalists by saying, we present both sides. Now, even if they presented both sides equally, number one, like you mentioned with global warming, should those two sides be given equal time, like with creationism and evolution? There will always be people who say it's not a heliocentric universe. should these people be given equal time? It's just that in a sense, I think that this is the default position that most journalists have, is like, let me present the story and people are educated. They can come up with their own, they can make up their own minds. And that's a really, that last part is the false assumption that people are educated and that they can make their own minds. I think that that's wrong. I think that just presenting the information in the way you present it is making up the minds of people for you.
And like, I feel like there's a, along with the intellectualism movement, there comes this weird thing where I feel like everyone thinks that they're an expert in something that they're really not. Like, they might just know a little bit more than their neighbor. They might just know a little bit more about this or that. But that doesn't put them on the same, like, that doesn't put them on the same plane of existence as an Albert Einstein when it comes to science. And, like, I've actually became kind of fascinated with this, common occurrence of people that actually believe that they can like come up with a counter argument to Einstein's theory of relativity. Like there actually like are a lot of people apparently that send in these theses that are like electricians that might know a bit about physics to universities that actually are trying to discount Einstein's theory of relativity. And I feel like that's along with this idea that we're all going to be like an expert if we just try harder or something.
You know what's weird though? As soon as you said that, I'm like, yeah, I'd be one of those guys. I think that I'll tell you why though, because I honestly think that we need a modified theory of gravity, because I think that dark matter is a bunch of fucking bullshit. And that every time they try to find it, everyone's like, we can't find it. So it must be in this one area we can't see. I'm like, fuck you, dude. Dark matter, you can suck my balls. I think we need a modified theory of gravity. But what do I know, right? I am literally a layman. I don't know anything beyond what I've already researched on my own. And like I said, not a fucking physicist. But I am severely not satisfied with what I'm saying. I wish I actually had more education. And I could find out whether or not I'm full of shit or not. Though the difference is this, while I may not fully accept the existing relativistic universe that people have come up with, and by the way, that there are plenty of other scientists who are also agreeing that perhaps time is not a dimension. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, hey, you know, as soon as I read that, I'm like, I must be correct. That is the problem. That, in a crux, yeah. That not that I'm saying that I ever actually think this way, but that's my instinct, right? And I try to find things that agree with me, and it's so easy now. It is literally the easiest thing in the world now to find things that agree with you. And I feel like perhaps the reason why we're all moving towards these polar opposites has a lot to do with that.
Right. Oh, totally. And I mean, just to take a completely different issue, if you believed in alien abductions, there are so many websites that would scare the shit out of you. That would like reinforce that to the extreme, and like, if whatever it is that you're looking for, whatever validation you're looking for, that information is available. And like, at what point, like, what is going to be the sort of compass of what information people should actually trust?
I guess the one thing I would, the one piece of advice I would try to tell people. Is that you have to read things, you have to educate yourself in things that you don't agree with. Because in a sense, the things you don't agree with not only highlight the weaknesses in your own philosophy or ideas, which I don't think that people fully appreciate just how tentative even our grasp on reality is. You know, where something as basic as the Higgs boson, which, you know, there's a level 5 sigma assurance, apparently, on its existence. But how much assurance was there before that came out? I mean,
right.
Stephen Hawking has bet $100 that they wouldn't find it. And this, apparently, is a fundamental fucking particle of reality that accounts for mass, which is a big deal. And we can't, like, even now, like, okay, 5 level sigma assurance, I'm sure I could still find a shitload of scientists, very respectable, extremely intelligent scientists that would tell you, not good enough.
Right.
And I don't even think that people realize what a 5 sigma level of assurance is. Like, you are not even sure about the, you know, your own wife as much as they are sure about the Higgs boson.
Like, right. Well, I mean, also the Higgs boson, I mean, to go back to your dark matter argument, I mean, that's kind of a good equilibrium. I feel like the Higgs boson was something that it was so important in theory. And that's why its discovery was both so important, but also like
problematic, kind of a thing.
Yeah, problematic to a certain degree. Like, there's when it comes down to it, I honestly believe it exists, and I trust.
But you're gonna do that whole postmodern, you find what you're looking for,
kind of a thing. Not so much. No, I mean, I wasn't really gonna go there. I feel like there's, my concern is that it fits into a narrative that still has yet to be completely discovered. Like, we know that it needed to exist, right? But there's like, I feel like to continue on this path, I should have
gotten a degree, like, though. Yeah,
I feel the same way. Like, there's probably an expansive world that I can go into here. But I was simply just trying to bring up like the sort of the equivalency from, you know, the Higgs boson as like a theoretical argument to then its eventual, you know, sigma five.
It's graduation to reality.
Yeah, exactly. It's a graduation to reality to your previous discussion about dark matter. So that's what I was just doing.
Well, I don't want to get into subjects that I can definitely assure you that I'm not an expert on.
Oh, I am totally not an expert on it.
I'm not entirely sure what my expertise is just yet. I'm sure that once I find out, somebody's going to let me know and be like, I think you're an expert in... I'm becoming an expert in nonsense as I, you know, write my book, Bible Stories. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know how I feel about that. I'm becoming really becoming knowledgeable about giants like Nephilims and other stupid shit that didn't exist.
do you find any interest in like how effective internet pranks are sometimes? Like, going back to that nonsense thing?
No, because I always get caught in them. A couple of days ago I posted a tweet that I thought was from Morgan Freeman until I realized that was not how he spelled his name. And I'm like, you got me again, you fucking internet. You made me look like a fool.
Did you believe in the Samsung apples thing? Like, when Samsung sent 30 trucks full of pennies to Apple?
That was a lie?
That was a lie.
Son of a bitch. I totally believe that. Fuck.
See, this is how effective, like, sometimes, you know, it fits that narrative. That fits this narrative that we kind of want. And, like, in a way, that's how nonsense, I think, is so effective.
Yeah. Damn it, now I feel like a fucking idiot. I was telling everybody about how I felt that Samsung was cool for sticking it to Apple, but that is probably right there. That is the narrative all wanted.
Apple became a dogma, and their narrative was created to like fight against this sort of giant super company that's patenting everyone out of existence.
Although, okay, like, tell me this. Maybe you don't know this, but there was this one article that could also be a lie, that a Chinese company had a patent for something on the iPhone 5 and they're going to patent troll them. That's what I read, and it could be a fucking lie!
I read that too. That was on... I saw that on Huffington Post, so...
It's probably a lie.
I think it's like 50-50 there. Like, they do actually... They have a pretty good reputation of calling out lies. Depending on the context.
Bad reputation when it comes to fucking woo-woo shit. Let's just say that.
I feel like it would be really kind of an interesting development when China tries to, like, troll the United States when it comes to patent law.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about it from that perspective. It's like, well, things are about to get a lot more interesting. But it could just all be false. It could just, again, play into our existing prejudices, our existing anger and fear. And, you know, in a sense, I think that's always that's a good reminder. That one story there is a good reminder that as soon as something sounds too good to be true, mm-hmm. again, it is. It probably is. Just a load of bullshit. I suppose, in a sense, we're all... We give everyone the benefit of the doubt immediately.
Right.
Which is a mistake.
Especially
mistake.
You know what I mean? Like, I feel like in this age of instant information and, like, the first to get that information out there, like, kind of wins this internet prize. Like, they get the most likes on Facebook or the most shares. That leads us to kind of bite into things that really haven't been vetted by reality.
Oh, man, you don't even know the sad part of it. I mean, in a sense, like, speaking as an internet producer, there's always this temptation to just talk about what everybody else is talking about, right? Like, let's pretend I did a post right when Octomom was like a big fucking deal or whoever else, right? I would get a real benefit from doing this. There's an incentive to talk about things that are just like masturbatory in a sense, like just us prattling on about issues where no one is bringing anything to the table that's new. We're all just talking about it because we want a sweet taste of all that fucking traffic.
Right. Yeah.
And you know what? Let me ask you this question, because I talked to my last interview was with the band Quiet Company, and they've been getting like internet famous. But the one thing that we left the interview with, he was in, I think, was it Atlanta at the time? And he was just about to go to do a concert, and he's like, well, I don't know how it's going to be, because while we might be big online, it doesn't always translate to fucking reality. Now, let me ask you this question. Is that fucking true? I mean, like, you're starting to have online success. What's the deal with that?
It's totally true. Because you can't really quantify a real show experience online. I mean, I feel like there's communication of music online is a very isolated experience. And when you go to a show and you have that sort of experience live with a group of people, that changes your attitude towards the band. Because right now, like, when you're a band, you're just an MP3 on someone's iPod. Or you're just, like, a playlist that someone has. They might not even know the song. Like, for example, like, my band, we had a hit back in the MySpace days. Like, we were getting, like... It was it sucked for us when MySpace died. It really, really, really kind of killed a lot of steam we had.
I think it killed a lot of musicians, actually.
It did, because, I mean, there really hasn't been a replacement format.
Well, Facebook sucks for music, too. They don't allow any fucking... They don't allow you to change your page, to add music and shit. It's kind of balls for musicians.
It's really gone to the core of, like, where in MySpace, the dynamic was that people want to become friends with musicians. And Facebook, musicians want people to be their friends.
That's a dangerous dynamic change.
It really is. And what that really is that you create a product that's on someone's MP3 player. You create a playlist. You create something that shows up next to something else that's nothing to do with what you created. And although I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, like, I'm not one of those people that goes out preaching that this new movement is killing music, but I do think it takes away from, like, the sort of ownership of the experience. Like, when you own a song, you don't have pride in that band. And so many times I would tell people about my band name. By band, I'd mention our name, and they wouldn't have heard of us, and then they'd go back and realize that we're on their iPod. Like, because they associate more with the song. They associate more with the song than the band.
It's true. The one thing I feel is particularly, I don't know if I'm going to say toxic about the whole thing, is just that you get an inflated sense of your own importance. I remember my most humiliating experience was during the Reason rally. I had asked a whole bunch of people to come for it, and come and meet me finally for the first time. And I'm like, my financial situation at the time was dire, but I had a fan who sent me like a bunch of money, and I used part of that money to actually take a trip down to Washington, because I thought, if I go there and I really meet physically with people, it'll have a lasting impression more so than this whole online thing, which is just not, it will not be enough. I cannot just be online dude and then just be like, all right, I'm going to retire now. I'm just going to keep posting things online. I'm just going to be fucking rich. Yeah, that's not how it works. But I go there. Nobody fucking shows up practically. The people that show up are the ones that I already sort of brought with me. And while the next day, a whole bunch of people were like, oh, I intended to go, but I didn't. And you realize, how can you be internet famous and still be such a fucking loser in the real life? Like, what?
You know, there's that happens a lot where people be like, oh, you're finally in my city, and this is probably the only time you're going to play here, because, like, you know, how often do we go to Omaha? And then be like, oh, sorry, we missed that. We're totally planning on going. That happens all the time. And I think that part of it is just because the supply is just
it's too great.
Supply for entertainment is too great. Yeah. And so people can kind of look at you as a product. And
especially if you sell yourself as a product, because I do, right? I sell myself as a product. I'm like, get membership and that kind of stuff. So in a sense, I may destroy all goodwill by doing that.
Well, I feel like just it's when you're just a product, you're part of someone's daily life, you're part of their routine, they probably listen to you when they're at the gym, when they're driving home from work. Like there's a sort of
50% of,
you know,
my fucking fan base, gym and work.
And there's nothing wrong with
that.
No, like,
of course
that's a great
not.
Demographic to have.
Why do you think I do shows Mondays and Wednesdays? I try to be like, those are the worst days for anybody.
Yeah.
I'm like, let me fucking put some sunshine in your goddamn day.
And that's also the most the busiest gym day, apparently, is Monday.
Totally.
But there's like that association with the live association, that really is what I think makes people gravitate towards you as a community.
I guess it needs to feel real, yeah.
Yeah, and like that's, as a musician especially, touring, because touring is so important, like having that tour base is so crucial. And if you don't have that, you might be famous online, but you can't make money.
See, now you're just forcing me, by the time I write my book, to do a book tour. And that's the most frightening thing in the world for me.
Really, why is that?
Well, number one, it's going to be expensive. And number two, I'm so accustomed to just, I record shit, I put it out there, and that's it. And I mean, if you get people reacting to it, which is still rare, I mean, once in a while a person be like, hey, that was a good show. I mean, what does that mean now? I don't even know. I feel like all the shows are all pretty good. If somebody messaged me being like, that was great, maybe that's a bit different. But it's sort of like it all washes through, and you're just like, I don't know if it means anything anymore. And you just feel generally, like I said, disconnected from absolutely everything. But that's a huge advantage sometimes, because in a sense, being disconnected means that I don't get asked uncomfortable questions. Nobody says anything that sort of makes me feel like I want to run out of the room.
Or if they did, you could just edit it out.
Right, exactly. Even this show will have its own edits. Well, mostly it'll be anytime you say or something. I'm going to make you sound good, dude. I do that for all my guests, though. That's my special thing. I'm like, you should sound brilliant. I'm going to make sure that you sound brilliant, by the way.
Oh, great. Yeah, I mean, like, I'm kind of sitting here and like, I'm not that familiar.
Yeah,
with
don't worry about it.
Talking on podcasts. So thank you. That would be great.
Well, you are a bit of a podcast noob. You admitted this yourself. I try to do a little bit of digging, as I always do before I interview someone. And it was a bit tough. I mean, I found there was this one interview from Kiwi Box or something like that. That was the one thing I found that was somewhat informative. But it was just like one of those regular musical interviews. Was like, can you tell me about your music without being any specific about the motivation behind it or having any interesting conversation about why you produced it?
Right. Yeah, those are the worst. And like, how can you make something sound interesting when you're just saying what you can read in liner notes?
Oh, not even just liner notes. Is that, you know, I know that a lot of the people who write for, you know, like for individuals who follow music, I don't know if they're trying to be neutral or they're just trying to kind of like, I don't know, appeal to everybody. But I often felt like there was no substance. Like the people that they interviewed might have something interesting about them. Like when I interviewed Quiet Company, I had found maybe one interview that briefly dealt with their whole non-belief and how that affected their music. That was a one paragraph. Like, what?
Right.
You're not doing a whole fucking interview on this? What are you talking to this person about? Where did you come up with the name of your band? I'll be honest, Dan, I don't care too much about where you got the name for your band. Like, I'm sure it's a great story and somebody's already covered it.
It's never a good story. Like, if you want to know how almost every band gets its name, is that they're like, oh, we need a band name. Let's come up with ideas. Like, that's... That's how 99%, like, I would say, like, every once in a while, there's probably a bunch of people out there that are just, like, sitting there, be like, that come up with a great band name, and like, oh, if we played instruments, this would be brilliant. But unfortunately, when you're a musician, you think too much about things, and you're like, no, we have to name this the right thing. Let's create a list. Let's make a priorities. Let's make a hierarchy of this and ask our friends.
See, this is why I must not be a musician, because when I wanted to do a band, This is an electronic band back when, do you remember, you ever use Fruity Loops? Does this sound like, do you remember Fruity Loops?
I remember Loops? Them.
Oh, yeah, man, I love Fruity Loops. Fruity Loops was like, I don't know, it was a music program for people who didn't know shit about music.
Right.
That's what it was. You got to take samples and just make random noises. And I already picked a name for a band. You want to know what my band name was?
Sure.
It was called The Offices of Jam.
Really? The Offices of Jam?
The Offices of Jam. Yep.
That would be an amazing, I feel like, parody band.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've always wanted to do parody bands. In fact, there was a band that I always wanted to parody every single one of their songs. And Jeff and I, one of my co-hosts, we were pretty serious about doing it. We wanted to make a Hall & Oates, band in a sense. But except for we would make false documentaries about how Hall & Oates stole our music. Because, you know, if you're going to accuse anyone of stealing the greatest music you've ever produced, you would accuse Hall & Oates.
Of course, yeah. That's perfect target.
And it, I don't know if anybody remembers what they look like, but they make great Halloween costumes. If you come to a Halloween dressed as Hall & Oates, you're fucking legend as far as I'm concerned. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. That's great. I'm actually, like, this is a bit off topic, but I'm actually in the process of writing something for the first time myself. It's not a book. I don't think I have the vocabulary for a book, but it's sort of about my my first band, which was a Nirvana cover band, but we were all like 10 years old. And I'm starting to realize like how ridiculous that was. I mean, Nirvana was popular at the time. I played piano in a Nirvana cover
band. I mean, the piano solos in the Nirvana songs really hit the spot.
Oh, yeah. They were like, you know, Come As You Are makes totally sense, you know, when you're playing the bass line on piano.
Oh, God, that sounds painful.
Well, it was interesting, though, because even though the idea was so ridiculous, we took it so seriously, and we were all just a bunch of nerds. Like, you're thinking of, like, the nerdiest people, but we were also the first band in our grade. So for, like, 4 months, I had a taste in the worst period of my life of, like, what it was like to be cool.
Oh, so that's why you're a musician now.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I'm constantly reaching back to that time.
Let me ask you this question. You weren't that douchey dude in college that was always pulling out a guitar and playing it in front of other girls, were you?
No, I'm incredibly afraid of people. I used to be incredibly afraid. Like in college, my number one fear was being embarrassed. And I feel like that comes from growing up as a nerd. So I would have like a very tight-knit group of friends, and even them I'd be afraid to show any music. I actually studied politics in college, so the music thing was kind of like a secret. I mean, people that were my friends knew that I was like composing for a while, but even when I, like, the first song that got me a record deal, essentially, I was just writing that in my apartment as kind of just for fun. And it's kind of, it totally makes sense that I became an internet phenomenon and not like a cultural, like a community phenomenon. I never tried to reach out to like the masses and say like, hey, come see me. I was like, just here you go.
No. Right. And you
want to walk away now.
And the problem you didn't realize is that being an internet phenomenon doesn't mean jack shit to your cool meter.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
It's disturbing. It's like every once in a while too, like something cool will happen to you. Like you'll talk to someone and even someone famous will be like, hey, I really dig your stuff. And you'd just be like, wow, that's cool. All right. But I'm still not paying the bills.
Exactly. I got a message from Courtney Love, actually. That was probably the perfect like circle from like my
oh my god, you did. It must have blew your mind.
It would have if it wasn't from her intern. Her intern messaged me and she was like, hey, just so you know, Courtney really likes your song.
I have a very strange impression of her, although I read Neil Strauss's The Game. I don't know if you ever read that book.
I never did.
Okay, well, he has a whole chapter about the weirdness that is Courtney Love. And after after that book, could not look at her the same way.
In what sense? Like, what's something that
well,
like,
he lived with her for a little while. And it's just that when he describes her personality, it strikes me as insanity meets schizophrenia.
Uh-huh.
Like,
yeah.
this is the only way I can describe this woman. As in, I think that a person who's already mentally unstable was allowed to continue to live an unstable life.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's like if you prop up someone with like borderline personality disorder and you pay them for it.
Yeah, what's going to happen? I mean, and at the same time, like, there's a part of you that's like, well, you know, we ensure that she has something to eat, but that means that you have to watch the train wreck. And, it's, and you know, train wrecks can be gut-wrenching.
They can be gut-wrenching, but they're also that's part of entertainment. Unfortunately, yes. once you're an entertainer, that eventual and obligatory burn up in flames moment is also just as equally entertaining.
I think that's perfect why they always call it like a train wreck, because a train wreck is something that you can't help but look at. Like if you were driving down the road and you saw a train wreck, we'd be like, oh, that's no big deal. I'm not going to rubber neck. Even though you know that if you look at a train wreck, you might just see some fucking body parts all over the place. I mean, shit, you don't want to see. But, I mean, by that time, it's out of your hands, man. The fucking monkey side of your brain's like, I want to see it.
No, you don't want to see it, but you have to. Or else you'll just constantly be thinking about what you might have missed.
It's going
to
eat you inside. Yeah, it's the weird... It's that kind of part of you that has to be like, I need to stop looking at train wrecks, because that doesn't make me happier. This is just... But, I mean, who's going to stop you? Who is going to stop you from, like... And you know what? In a sense, I feel like maybe that's part of our own lives. I mean, I don't want to sound like a fatalist. But, I mean, there are certain days where I'm just reading the news, and I feel like I'm in a train that's headed super fast towards another train, headed super fast towards a collision, and I'm like, I can't look away, and I don't know what to do.
I think also, like, you know, when it comes to our desire to watch entertainers go through these train wrecks, I actually have this theory that, we intentionally killed the rock star in a way. I feel like the rock star was something that was kind of created in late 50s, but really came to its peak in the early 90s, really came to its peak like in the last days of the record industry, was actually making
you
money.
You mean the image of the rock star? Like a
exactly, the image,
kind of...
Well, the image, but also the worship of the rock star. The way that like people were like putting up posters of this, you know, of whether it be like Kurt Cobain or... Billy Corgan, just like having these rockers that you identified with, and once that connection with that record that you owned became an MP3, then I think that like all it was almost a reaction from everyone that was like, oh, but I'm not a rock star, started to be like, oh, that's nothing, that's just a band on my iPod.
Are you sure? Because I would blame two bands for killing rock and roll. Mm-hmm. I would blame Rolling Stones and I would blame Aerosmith.
Really?
Yeah, and I'll tell you why. Both of these bands ruined rock and roll because who wants to watch an old motherfucker dance around flapping about their business? I mean, the whole thing about rock and roll is it's supposed to be a youth movement, rebellious movement, and now you have essentially these guys who used to represent this who obviously represent a new form of corporatism. I mean, like, hang up the fucking gloves, Mick Jagger. I don't want to see my grandpa rocking it out because it makes rock seem like it's an old man's game.
I think there's no musical movement that actually has a genre right now that represents a counterculture, but I think partly is because there actually is no counterculture. Like, there are small little niches of people that listen to some very interesting music but there's not some movement that is actually like a counter movement. Like, when you think of hippies, when you talk about hippies from before, I kind of think of hipsters. I mean, they might have some views, but really what the goal is to look cool and go to the right places.
Well, maybe in a sense that's always what it was. And the rest of it is just something that we just invented because we wanted to think that these people were deeper than they actually were. And maybe that's the part of the problem. We create these myths about the past that no one can really live up to. I mean, these are just people, flawed human beings. Maybe they wanted to change things, but in their own way, they were selfish idiots that really didn't think about the greater good. And how does that differentiate from us? How are we not selfish idiots that don't think about the greater good? I could probably point out to 10,000 objects even in your own home that point to the fact that you're a selfish fucking piece of shit. You know?
Yeah, probably.
The countless water bottles, the fucking aluminum can in your garbage. I mean, it probably just goes on and on and on. It's an indictment of ourselves, but I don't think that we're all really willing to do that. I don't think that we're really willing to sort of like look at ourselves honestly, be like, I think that to some degree, all the things that we pretend that we fight for, we don't. We're more likely to take very conservative attitudes, even though we pretend that we're actual, you know, rebels and we change the world. And that's a lie. Like, are you a rebel, Dan? I don't feel like a rebel.
I don't feel like a rebel anymore. I think I had moments of my life where I was actually, you know, going against the grain, but I think most of it was for social activity and to meet people and to have friends.
Meet girls. Like, if I'm a bad rebel, I'm going to get laid.
That was part of my incentive when I was an anarchist in college. I mean, I really went full frontal on that one. Like, but that was part of it was because I thought that I was like, oh, these people are cool. I want to hang out with them. They have cool parties. And a lot of it did have to correspond, I think, with the Iraq War, which is something that I was very much against. But I was certainly helped by the fact that I had a crush on one of the anarchist girls.
So many movements can be boiled down to that. And you know what? Their failures are easily explained as just like, well, there was a girl.
There's a girl. I mean, there's... I feel like there's also, like, I mean, right now, people feel like they're making change by posting things on Facebook. Or liking something or spreading something. And, like, there was a really funny, like, infographic. It wasn't so much an infographic. I think it was, like, I forget what they're called, but a layered series of events, like a timeline of like how people think that internet works, like when you like something.
Oh, you mean like eventually... that six pictures, it's like here's what I think. Yeah. We've seen all of those before.
What are those called?
I don't know. Collage, I guess, is probably the best way to put
it. It was like a assumption collage of when you like something, eventually that would lead to like clean drinking water in Africa. Like that was essentially the thesis.
Yeah, I remember that one. Click like, and all of a sudden the water gets purified and filtered, and Africans are drinking delicious, crisp, and cool water.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I feel like that's kind of like that's like our white man's burden. Oh, we have to like this and.
But don't you think it's almost the same as going over to a music festival and smoking weed? I mean, we all think that what we're doing is some kind of great social movement, and what we don't really realize is that to do this requires, you know, sacrifice, time, things that you're probably not putting in this whole movement.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, and I think that's part of the reason why hunger strikes are so effective. Because they happen so rarely, and like, who would do that? I think that's when everyone's like, why are they doing that? Like, what's the point? I mean, that's so
destructive,
that's so torturous, severe. And then we're like, wow, that guy's actually not eating for 3 months. That's crazy.
But the perfect, what you said was exactly it. I don't think that most individuals realize that personal sacrifice is what is necessary in any form of activism. Like, your life is going to suck in one way or another. And if it doesn't, if life is peachy, it's probably because you're not an activist.
Right.
You're probably just one of those people who's like, well, I just talk about it, that's good enough. You know, even I feel that way sometimes where I think that I'm actually doing something by talking. And some people buttress that idea by being like, well, you really helped out and I was listening to your show and it was comforting and blah, blah. But I have to remind everyone that this... is easy. This is the least that I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's shocking that there's people don't even do that much already, where they don't even lend their voices, where some people even liking is not possible. But I mean, I think that with most of the people in this world, even the whole like thing is the best you're gonna get.
Yeah. And it's better to have that than not. I mean, it's kind of like recycling, right? I mean, recycling makes you feel good. You're doing a good thing. Really, it kind of is like flapping your arms against falling, flapping your arms. It's really not really doing anything to solve most of what's fucking up the earth.
Yeah, and it's the last of the three R's, right?
Right.
What are the first two? Reduce and reuse. Are we really doing that?
No. That's yeah, exactly. I mean, but we can recycle. That's something that's easy and it makes us feel good. So we'll do that.
Well, it's a lot easier than actually working at stuff too. So, yeah. I mean, and like I said before, I mean, obviously changing the world requires work and dedication. And I'm not entirely sure that everybody either has that, or I'm not even entirely sure that everyone should do that. I mean, I just wish that Hitler would have just stayed a painter. You know what I mean? I don't need everyone to get involved. And I don't think any of us do need that. I just think that, in a sense, we should all kind of recognize our own hypocrisy. That would be better. It would be even better than people getting involved, because I think that a person who falsely thinks that they're making a difference is worse than the guy who doesn't and who admits that. Because at least the guy who doesn't do shit is like, well, I'm part of the problem. And the guy who does is like, I'm part of the solution. No, actually, you're not. Because you aren't the solution. You're just trying to put a Band-Aid on a fucking arterial wound. You are not the solution. And you thinking you're the solution is not helping anybody.
See, this is where I kind of disagree with you, honestly. I feel like if you have, I mean, en masse, like a bunch of people, millions of people, making that same tiny little Band-Aid, I think that could actually have an actual effect. I mean, at least, okay, let's put it into like an example of that. Let's say we all decided to buy a Chevy Volt. That would actually have an impact. It would also like have an impact in the amount of like pompousness that people feel like they're entitled to, but it would actually have a good impact to the earth. And so I feel like sometimes that little bit, that little incentive to feel like you're doing good, is kind of worth it, I feel.
All right, but let me ask you this question. Let's pretend that a certain person has like a certain amount of guilt points. All right, I can guilt you with say 20 points. In terms of all of the shit that you do, like let's pretend you run the shower too long, you throw out too much garbage, all of these things, right? And I got 20 points to try to convince you to do something that's actually going to help. Do you really honestly believe that I can spend those 20 points that will create, in the long run, a sustainable society? Or am I just convincing people that they're moving in that direction, even though we're headed to a fucking brick wall at 100 miles an hour?
Right.
I feel like the problem is, and just with recycling is a perfect fucking example, is that we're like, this is how you help, rather than saying, this is not enough even by a long shot. And we're consuming a lot of energy, we're using a lot of resources. Is that really the fucking best way that we can do it? I would ask a bunch of environmentalists, I'm sure I'd get like 10 fucking different answers, but most of them would probably be like, no, this is not the real solution. But now that everyone's convinced that it is, it kind of becomes its own thing, and I look like the bad guy for telling someone that their recycling is producing almost as much garbage as, you know, anything else. They would be better off not fucking buying it, but they're like, well, I'm recycling, so that should be good enough.
No, you do make a good point there. I mean, especially because that's like the reason why everyone recycles is because it's not politically dangerous. You're not going to, going out and say, recycle everyone, you're not going to get a bunch of, like, anti-global warming fanatics, like, posting on your wall by saying you're going to recycle.
No, they're going to say the exact same thing you did. Well, at least it's better than nothing.
Yeah. And, like, I feel like there's, I do agree with you. I think that, the context in which people can make change is very now. I mean, it's neuter to the extent, like, if it's a more unique NBC, like if it's just like a little thing, like hey FII, it's not gonna really make that much of a change. It does require everyone to believe that, for example, with the environment, like it does require everyone to believe that this major fucking brick wall that we're about to hit exists in the first place.
Right, we're still having a discussion about whether or not we're headed towards, ultimate destruction. And it's so funny too, because you know part of that discussion is you'll have somebody will say, well, the atmosphere is so big that we can't possibly affect it. And I'm like, you know, when I look at a mountaintop and I see snow and I realize that I can't breathe if I was to walk just vertically for an hour or so, I would run out of oxygen. You realize you are a atmospheric bottom feeder. That is what you are. And yet you're just saying it doesn't matter if I shit in my fucking bowl, it'll be fine because there's so much of it around. And you're just like, are you for real, guy? And I mean, even if tomorrow somebody's like, oh, we have new emission laws and they're slightly better, and everyone's gonna be like, well, I wash my hands and we're done. It's almost like I'm like, did we use up those points, the guilt points, that we could have actually done something that was really much more useful.
Right, and I feel like and the context, even taken outside of in the environment, we're having this whole, it's still a very contentious issue, is affirmative action, which I feel like the reason why it's so politically dangerous and so volatile is because it was trying to be a Band-Aid issue, as opposed to being maybe we should spend a lot of money focusing on building schools,
or getting rid of the systematic racism in the system.
Exactly, getting rid of the systematic racism by actually creating a fair playing ground and making playing field and making sure that everyone gets a proper education. And that's a lot harder to convince people. It's a lot harder to do. So they kind of slapped on this fix-all solution that actually caused more people to react and get angry and become slightly more racist, actually.
Yeah, there's a deep irony there that Band-Aid solutions, in a lot of senses, make things worse, make it more difficult for you to actually have, that conversation, because you're gonna have one segment of the population be like, it's already been dealt with, and the other segment be like, this is wrong, and they might have good points about why it's wrong, and you find yourself if you're just saying, well, this is the lesser of two evils, you have to defend something that you don't agree with. Mm-hmm. And that just sucks. And I think that most people who are even listening to the show, or in a few, in a month and something, or I don't know how long, they're going to have to vote. And most of the people who are listening to the show probably feel like, I'm having to vote for a party that still I don't agree with.
Right.
And I know that there's plenty of people that are like, I'm not even going to vote. I actually suggest that's a really fucking terrible idea, and you should work with the devil that you know rather than the devil that you don't. But how do I convince a person who still has no real representation to vote for someone who only has a marginal interest in their well-being?
Right. And that's essentially the problem. I think that's the problem with just partisan politics in the first place. There's no incentive for someone to join a coalition if they don't think that coalition is ever doing anything for them.
Right. Except for, of course, if the reason they join that coalition is to make sure that another coalition doesn't make their life more miserable.
Exactly. And that's why you had a lot of kids that weren't giving a shit back in 2008 starting to care. I feel like that the reason why the youth vote was so big in 2008 is just because it was totally a reactive experience.
Do you think that's still going to be just as strong now, or do you think there's going to be a lot of people that are just no-shows?
I think there's going to be more no-shows. I think in general it's going to be a lot less enthusiastic on the youth vote, but I still think it's going to be there more than it was in 2004, at least for the Democrats. Because there are, just for a very objective reason, there are a lot of people that have healthcare now, and I think that actually is a big deal. If you're 24 and you're trying to find work and you don't have it and you're on your parents' healthcare for the first time because you're allowed to, that actually is a very economic reason to vote.
True, and one of the things that people don't realize, actually, the economic collapse in 2008 was due more to bankruptcies due to healthcare than it was due to people not being able to pay their mortgage. I don't think anybody realizes that is what caused, a major factor in what caused the 2008 collapse. It's like no one has healthcare, and when they do get sick, they have to put their houses as collateral. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what's going to happen when they get sick and they lose their job and shit? It is over.
Right.
And you can only have so many. It was one of the, I think, the least talked about aspects of the economic collapse, because everybody was, everybody had their own pet theory, and there were plenty of other things to blame for. There was this weird way that they rearranged bad assets so that people were selling junk fucking, what's what I'm looking for, funds. Masking all the risk.
Yeah,
and that's definitely a huge factor. But what people didn't realize is that if the people in the United States had some kind of healthcare system, it would have been manageable. But everyone's sort of like, oh, I have health problems, the economy's collapsing, well, I'm done.
It's the collateral effect. I mean, I feel like the reason why it was so deep, I mean, yeah, default swaps and toxic assets were that was what sparked it, right? But that was fixed first. The bank and the financial industry, the banking and financial industries, were the first to be fixed. They're the first to rebound. But then after that, you have all the people that were fucked in that, where it was the domino effect of when they did lose all the value of their house and they were banking on that to pay for their operations or banking on their job to give them healthcare, that just created that's a much more, like, I do think it's an exponential crisis. I mean, the only people that were really affected I shouldn't say the only people, but not as many people were affected by the bank collapses as were by then the collateral of that.
Yeah, no, there was an assumption about the value of that, and that's what really left people screwed. It turns out they're like, oh, half of the value of your assets is just make-believe. It's like, right. We're just going to take that away. And most people didn't realize that, you know, there's still stories that I read from individuals who tell me that they can't leave their jobs because that one job that they fucking hate has a health plan.
Mm-hmm.
And most other fucking industrialized nations don't have these types of problems. I mean, I love how America just talks about being like, well, this is a free market and people get to dictate what they want. I'm like, not when you hold them with a medical leash at their neck.
Oh, of course. No, that's a big part of how much you are able to move, like your mobility and a job. If it's tied to that healthcare, you might be if you stayed in your job during 2009, 2010, you were working twice as hard to keep that job because you couldn't move it, because you couldn't move to another job because you were afraid of like trying something new because you're so dependent on that. And like I do think that healthcare, it does act as a sort of cage. For that.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, there's a reason why we consider it a bit of a safety blanket. And it's funny, too, because I don't think that even politicians realize how important it is to have a healthy workforce. I mean, when we look at Africa and the problems in Africa, a lot of us, we might have some theories about what the problem is. Unstable governments, you know, not enough money in development, that kind of stuff. But the real problem is that all of the able workers are dying of fucking AIDS. Mm-hmm. And there's no one there to work. There's no one there to fucking grow crops. There's no one there that has enough experience to make an economy work. And you don't realize health is the most important thing in a workforce. You have no health, you have no workforce.
And if Africa had a workforce, their economy could be like the next China. I mean, if you really look at it, like how cheap it would be to relocate a business to Africa if that health concern wasn't an issue.
Well, I mean, I think that in the future, I'd like to think that Africa is going to be one of those look out in 20 years. But there's just so much work that still needs to be done. And we just need to realize that on the very basic level, the most important thing that you have is healthy people working. And even though maybe we live in an economy where we don't think that that's important, because I think that at least in the U.S., people think that the financial industry is more important than actual hard physical labor. And they don't realize that I'm like, investment is important, but without the real labor to provide, to make shit, you don't have anything. You just have a make-believe economy where people pretend that they're building things, but they're not. Like, ultimately, people need to work. They need to produce things, and they need to be healthy when they do it. And guess what happens when you have all those fucking factors in play? So.
Right. And well, they need to make money to buy the shit they're making.
Right.
Like, that's a sustainable economy. If you have a labor force that's healthy, that's making things, and then also making a wage to buy those things, then it can sustain itself. That's a good situation.
Well, it is the one part. This is probably my last little rant, but it's the one part that I feel that most rich people underestimate is that they think that the way to be rich is to have a massive underclass, a fucking poor class, and then just a few rich individuals. But wealth only started being, to reach absurd levels when another third class appeared, the middle class. Mm-hmm. And while the rich hate the middle class because, I mean, this was the same problem in medieval or Renaissance Europe where all of a sudden, hey, the middle class is starting to dress like rich people and they didn't like that too much, them flaunting around their cash. But what they didn't realize was that was good for them in the long run. You cannot have an economy where there's only rich people and, only poor people and a few rich people. Those rich people will not be as rich as if they lived in a place with a totally diverse class system. And you're just like, people need to buy your products, rich people, you fucking morons. You think poor people buy your shit? They buy shit from China. That's what they buy. Yeah. They don't buy cars. They don't buy houses. I mean, this is the message I want to say to rich people right now, if you're rich. Since student debt has now overtaken credit card debt, and now that the average 30-year-old is living with his parents and doesn't even own his own car, who's going to buy your shit?
What is their incentive to think that it's a better society if we go back to this sort of middle-age like serf system? I mean, those are, when you have like a system where you have nobles and kings, and the reason why you can control the people is because you have like swords and like horses, that's something that cannot be recreated in a modern context, especially when voting exists, and that might be why they're trying to get rid of it.
That's possible. Okay, I want to wrap it up because the show's getting a little bit long. But before we go, I want to talk a little bit more, just sort of like wrap it up in terms of what it is. What is it like? You guys, your band, right? Mm-hmm. You mentioned before that touring was important. Are you guys like? Is there like a big tour coming? Like, how are you guys trying to inject yourself into the physical world now?
Well, see, that's the thing. We actually don't have tours lined up just because... No, yeah, sorry. It's just like there's nothing to pitch to you guys. No, we don't have a tour lined up. We do play a lot of shows in New York and Boston. Right now, what we're kind of focusing on is actually just songwriting and, like, recording. I feel like we've kind of accepted the fact that we have an internet base. And
you're servicing that internet base.
Yeah, we're gonna keep on writing songs, and I think that we all enjoy that more than touring, honestly. And if we happen to get a song out there that does blow up and it's worth going on that tour, then we would go on that tour. Unfortunately, we've just spent so much time going on tours and having some good shows, some bad shows, and like having to take off what other jobs we might have and losing money in the process. So we're kind of like taking this attitude that like we really enjoy writing songs and recording and coming up with like new themes for like albums. So we're gonna kind of focus on that for a while before we really dig in and try another tour. Though we do head to Europe every once in a while. That's actually more fun.
Okay, well there you go, internet. Plush Gun is servicing your ass, which means they're staying put and they're producing more content. Is that the nice way to put it?
That exactly, yeah.
Fucking fantastic. Well, yeah, thanks for joining me, Dan, and we're going to have a bunch of your songs and links to the stuff on the show, so I recommend people check out the notes, check out your shit, and like it. Even though it's not activism, just do it. It's the least you can do, motherfuckers. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks so much.
All right, everybody, have a good Atheist Day.
If it weren't for X on, there'd be no Santa Claus. No, we can't. No, we can't. Save the auto industry. But it worked, goddammit. Now we can't accept history. No, we can't, no, we can't tell you about a plan. There's a reason why they call it the invisible hand. We can't let gays marry. The Bible tells the truth. And we can't help you pay for college, you disenchanted youth. We can't let a patient get the healthcare that they need. Unless you're rich, it's your fault if you're sick. No, we can't, no, we can't let Mexicans on our land. We can't let them.